This podcast is presented by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, safer, healthier people.
Okay. Thank you very much. Right. Thanks, guys. We're talking more about the future so far, and I'll be there in a minute, but I'd like to take you back into the past a little bit. Some of you may remember the last millennium. It's quite some time ago. But in the last millennium, about the 1990s, the various people, Ray Kurzweil was one of those, some of you might know, saying that in the future we're not going to need passports, and we're not going to need credit cards, and we're not going to need keys for our cars. What we're going to have is a little implant under the skin that will identify us to the system, to computers, and that's it. So if we're walking from one country to another through passport control as it is now, we'll just walk through a ding-ding-ding computer will know it's us, and that's it. But in the 1990s, no human had actually tried anything like that until 1998. I did. What I had implanted in my left arm was on the right-hand side there, on the left-hand side, just the scale is the typical salary of a professor. So that wasn't implanted. What was implanted on the right-hand side, radio frequency identification device. Some of you probably have a cat or a dog with this thing in them now. It was trialed with humans before the animals. We have to be safe. You can't have cats and dogs having things that could be dangerous. Now, what that did, just to demonstrate what was possible, what we got into doing my building in Reading, walking down the corridor, computer knew it was me, so the light came on. Going to the laboratory, the door opened automatically. Coming through the front door, it said, "Hello, Professor Warwick." Of course, we came in now, we're much better friends. But it was fun, demonstrated what we could. Some people said at the time, criticised, "Oh, what did you do this for? People are never going to want anything like that." Well, if you have a look now, just surf the web, you'll see it. We wanted to get into a nightclub called the Bayer Beach Club. There's one in Rotterdam, there's another in Barcelona. You can't just walk in, you have to have a little implant like this, and then you get access to particular areas, and you don't need to take cash or a credit card. If you have a drink, you just wave your arm, and that's it, it's automatically charged to your account. It's serious, it's automatically charged to your account. There's reportedly about 100 members of the Mexican government have an implant, a little bit smaller, but have an implant like this, so only they get access to high security areas, and even, as far as I'm aware, the American Medical Association are reportedly trialing these for certain types of patients where there is patient information, so that when the patient needs certain medication, it's on the implant that says this is what they need, this is the problem. So that if they're having a fit or a particular problem, the information is there directly, exactly what the patient needs and information on the patient's background. So it doesn't matter about medical records being lost or in the computer. You don't need the computer, you just need the information. But I want to talk about something a bit more in terms of connections between humans and technology. And it's really, I guess, if some of you saw the documentary film years ago, the American politician part of the film, the documentary film was called The Terminator. I don't know if any of you saw it. And there was the politician, of course, was Arnold Schwarzenegger. And in that documentary film, this type of human technology link was referred to as a cyborg, part human, part machine. And that's really part of what I'm looking at here, this concept. Not just about human medication. Humans can be upgraded potentially into cyborgs, and that's for me a lot more interesting. Now, in terms of what's possible with cyborgs, for I know this is CDC, and maybe science fiction is not what we're into at all, but I would like to, if you bear with me, just stay in the world of science fiction for a moment. Because there was another film a year ago called I, Robot. And in that film, a guy called Will Smith played sort of part of a cyborg. He had an artificial arm which had super powerful strength and so on. Now, fortunately, he came over to London for the European premiere of the film My Robot, and a CNN reporter was able to ask him what he felt was possible as far as being a cyborg was concerned. So I'd like to start off with a few words from Will Smith, if that's okay.
Small percentage.
sanctus. There's all sorts of signals, infrared, X-ray, ultraviolet, ultrasonic signals, and so it goes on, enormous range of signals. We don't sense, and hence we don't perceive. It's not that they're not important, of course they're important, but we don't perceive them. We don't have any effect on us. Whereas machines, of course, can sense the things that we sense, vision, we see, robots with vision and so on, but also they can sense ultrasonic, ultraviolet, X-ray, and so on. If I can link my brain, my nervous system, to technology, could I have some of those senses? Just take infrared. Your television set senses infrared signals, you know. You don't. Aren't you a little bit jealous of that? But the point is, do you have to be a little bit jealous? Can you have an infrared sense? Well, yeah, why not? But the technology is there. And if you can, what will your brain make of it? Will your brain be able to deal with it? Will it be too much for it? And if you could have an infrared sense, what would it be like? To me, this is important research. To be able to mess around with silly little algorithms just to publish papers that maybe a lot of academics do, but to actually find out for humans, can we have extra senses? If so, what's it going to do to us? One of the things I do is, I suppose I'd like to think of playing around with robots in official use research, but trying out different things with robots to see how they think about things, how they interact and so on. And just to show you some of the robots, I've got a clip here from a BBC programme called Inventions That Change the World.
Thank you. was sort of way about it.
It's always difficult to make direct comparisons between human animal brain cells and machine and so on. Well, I did actually say that there was 50 to 100 brain cells, about the same as slugs and snails and Manchester United supporters. There are two other, what I would regard as distinct advantages of artificial intelligence that potentially we could benefit from. One is that the human brain has evolved to think about the world around us spatially as being three-dimensional, whereas, of course, the world is not three-dimensional. You can put any numbers of dimensions on space and so on that you want, and mathematicians and physicists, whatever the latest fashion is. And even if you gave me a 10-dimensional problem, either I'd have to chop it up into threes and twos in order to try and understand what's going on, or I would give it a computer to do, because computers can deal with multi-sensory information. But if I can link my brain to a computer, start to understand things, even in four or five dimensions would be fine, because it would give me an enormous edge over everyone else who's still thinks. Biggest advantage of all that for artificial intelligence clearly is communication. Because if you look at how humans communicate now, it's something we've done the same way for thousands upon thousands of years, and it is so poor, really, it's pathetic, to be embarrassing that we still do. When you look, what's happening now? I wake up, just like everyone else, highly complex electrochemical signals, my thoughts, my ideas, whizzing around. And if I want to get some of those across to you, what do? Well, my mouth converts them to mechanical signals, pressure waves. That's what it's doing now. And out of those trivial coded messages, because that's what speech is, serial signals, out of those signals come, and your ears convert them back from mechanical pressure waves into electrochemical signals, and you try and put on some concept of what it was I was originally thinking about. Of course, even if any of you have been married 30, 40 years, you still no idea what you're talking about. And when you're talking to students, you tell students one week something, you tell them again the next week, you tell them again the next week, and it comes to the exam, many of them have no idea what is you talking about. The point is here, your brain is electronic, my brain is electronic. Why can't we just communicate? Zoop, directly. Doesn't matter if the other person's looking out of the window or thinking of something else. Zoop, there's the message. We probably don't need exams anymore. We'll save all sorts of costs in universities for second exam. We know that people know this stuff. The point is it possible to communicate like that? Is it possible? Because if we can do, surely it's worth looking at. Because we open up all sorts of possible, like parallel communication, instead of this old-fashioned serial form. Maybe sending across ideas and concepts and all sorts of things, rather than just this coded message. Maybe even linking up to the internet and using the power of the internet. So all these things, memory, mathematical ability, sensing in other ways, thinking in many dimensions, and perhaps most of all, communication, all the ways in which, as cyborgs, upgraded humans, linking by technology, we could enhance our abilities and seem to be worthwhile doing it. Now, I've talked about humans so far, but some research goes on with animals. We have a project at the moment in Reading, which involves culturing neural tissue, growing neural tissue, in order to drive around the little robots that we're looking at. So the neural tissue is being taught to do simple things, like move around, not bump into things, in order to drive the robot. So just to be clear with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So it's a good, a fancy shirt.
Brilliant.
Just to be clear on that, I can hear myself now. The robots that are looking at there, the bodies are the robots that we saw, but the brains of the robots are not computers, the brains are biological tissue, neural tissue that is growing in order, and all the neural tissue knows is as a robot. It doesn't know anything, all it knows is the senses of the robot, and all it does is move the robot around. So the brain is a robot brain, but it's biological. But there are other research going on. And from this, you can get ideas as to what is possible as far as humans are concerned. Now, one set of research I just want to share with you. This is from John Chapin from New York. This is actually taken from Korean television. I understand, I checked before I came. I know you're all fluent as part of the job here with Korean, so it should be no problem with this.
By combining technology, by using an actual computer chip on the rack to deliver essentially stimulus cues to the brain, we can start to train the rat to go do different things. Now, rat.
So what John has done is put implants in the brain of the rat in order to control the rat to move to the right, to the left from a computer. So literally press a button on the computer and off the rat goes. So you have to think not so much in terms of a rat here, but perhaps your husband or your wife or boyfriend, girlfriend, and you can press a button, and whereas he's pressing a button, the rat goes right or left, you can press a button and stand up, sit down, fetch me some coffee, that sort of thing. So you get the idea. I was just saying, looking at the possibilities here, I can see some of you see the commercial opportunities on this one anyway. And of course, some politicians already have this sort of implant in, I'm told. Now, what they've also done with the rat is put a camera on the head of the rat so they can see where the rat's going. So this is like a teleoperated rat. They can take it to a bomb or another dangerous area or weapon.
Brought all those capabilities under our ability to guide it. So now we can actually find the bomb without us having to go there, but with us still being able to see the video images of all of the areas that the rat has gone through.
And there are lots of other examples with animals. I'm not sure why it is when animals volunteer for these experiments. Rats always seem to be front of the queue. I'm not sure why that is. I want to stick really to human machine, human technology links. What I've talked about so far are the possibilities of enhancement. And if any of you thought that's a science fiction and it's why don't I get on with it? Well, you'll see, stick with it, it's not. I mentioned about five things that maybe you thought, well, this is way into the future. Two of them we've already got a big tick against. It's not science fiction, it's very much science fact, as you will hear. But just for a moment, rather than look at enhancement, because maybe in some of your minds, maybe you think, well, ethically, I'm not sure about this enhancement. If I've got the extra sensory input, that's all right. But if this person next to me's got it and I haven't, I don't know that I fancy that too much. Possibly. But what is perhaps clearer, maybe, is when we look at therapeutic uses of this technology. And I some of you are familiar with this, maybe most of you, but it's just to get us into this a little bit more. What I'm going to show is a video of an individual with Parkinson's disease, and they've received the deep brain stimulator that's produced by Medtronic, amongst others. So what you're going to see is the person with Parkinson's disease, how they are, and then you will see them when the stimulators are switched on in terms of the power packs. The power packs are positioned at the top of their chest, and then their wires going up to control or to power the electrodes that are positioned into the central area of their brain, all fully implanted. So what you're going to see is the person with Parkinson's disease. The stimulators are switched on, and then you'll see them with purely electronic stimulation. Now, the two things to say here, this is, if you haven't seen this before, this is a genuine patient. This is genuine someone who has Parkinson's disease. This is not an actor or anything like that. The other thing to say, well, this was originally filmed at a Christmas party, and I think maybe some people had had a little bit too much to drink, because there's some laughter at the end that might not seem appropriate. So that's just explaining where that comes from.
I'd like to show you in 2 minutes what was the status of Mr. Plessman when he was referred to us by his neurologist in Belgium. And you see him before surgery without drug, unable to stand up by himself. He's helped by Patricia Limousin, who is a neurologist in our group. And he's not able to do anything of, as he will tell you, makes your life looking like normal. He's not able to walk. He has having dystonia, which are muscular contraction, deforming the different joints, and this is the best he could do without the drugs, with the help of people around him and maybe his wife and friends. He was referred because the drugs were not working anymore. He was not having any more improvement, and as he will tell me, he was just stuck to a wheelchair. This is after surgery, you see the tremor. We turn one of the two stimulators which were implanted in the electrode into this subarachnoid, which is a tiny part of the brain. And you see that in a few seconds, the stimulation induces the stop of the tremor. This is still visible on the other side. We will turn on the stimulator on the right side. And you will see something even more spectacular than that. You will see that the patient feels again free, and he reset himself in his chair, in the position where he can go to talk. He will obey Dr. Pollack in doing some tests, even if he feels that those tests are a little bit useless as compared to the feeling he has. He can do that almost normally on the right side. Let it go longer, as you say, and we'll show it on the other side. And then now he will walk, he stood up alone. He is without the drug. You see him walking, turning. It was a few days before the Vienna meeting, the movement disorder.
Now, this type of implant, so far it's been very successful. A lot of people received it. The surgeons we work with at Oxford put a new one in every week. That's just one hospital in the UK. But there's a couple of problems with it. One is that it operates in open loop. It's just putting a stimulating signal into the brain. There's no feedback there. And anybody that's into cybernetics or control systems, you need some sort of feedback to regulate or provide better performance. The other is more immediate, that when people have this implant, they leave it on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's stimulating all the time. And hence it overrides a lot of other effects going on in the brain. But the people want it stimulating all the time, because when it's on, they don't have Parkinson's disease to all intents and purposes. They can live a regular life, drive their cars and so on in most cases. Now, this uses up power quite considerably, and after a couple of years, the person has to go back to have new power packs put in place, which needs more surgery, and even looking at recharging devices through induction externally, it only lengthens the life of the batteries, so it's maybe surgery after 3 years instead of two. Now, what we're doing is working with the surgeons at Oxford to provide the next generation, we hope, of this type of implant. Now, just to give you some idea what's going on, what we're doing is using what is called an artificial neural network, if you like, a computer system, an artificial brain, dependent on how you want to look at it, to monitor what is going on in real time in the human brain in order to provide stimulation when it is needed. So what the system is doing is predicting when tremors are going to occur, before they occur, and is only stimulating before the tremors occur. So it's, if you like, it's trying to outthink the human brain before it does something, and then stopping it doing it before it does it. And what we can, so the first element of it is successfully predicting what the human brain is going to do before it does it, in terms of the tremors. Now what we see along that, this is some brief plots just taken from this is from somebody's brain, some of this. So this is from a patient. What we see along the bottom line, just to see what's happening, at about the 45 second mark, this is, the bottom line is EMG, muscular data, and this is movement, if you like, the tremors. Up to about 45 seconds, there's no movement. It's a regular person, no problem at all. And what we see coming in at the 45 second mark are the tremors. This is what all this is on the bottom plot. This is muscular movement showing that tremors are occurring. When we look at the plot above, this is local field potentials from the subthalamic nucleus. This is the third plot down, the one up from the bottom, if you like. And if you look at that, you can see the variation, the standard deviation of the signal is quite large. And then at about the 45 second mark, it diminishes at about the same time that the tremors start occurring. Now, our artificial neural network is sitting looking at this electrical data. It doesn't see the mechanical data, that really happens later on. It sees the electrical data from the central area of the brain. And if we look at the very top of the top plot, what that is showing is the output from our artificial neural network. And just to be clear, what we see, at about the 45 second mark, 45, 46 second, you'll see that the plot goes high and stays high. What that is doing is indicating that tremors are actually occurring. It's not predicting, it's just saying, yes, we've got tremors. The network has been trained to recognize tremors, and it's saying there are tremors. More importantly, at about the, this is the top plot we're looking at about the 14 second mark, and again about 19 seconds, the output goes high. Now this is indicating tremors are going to occur. It's some sort of prediction. But if we look at the bottom plot, we can see there are sort of a few little things. It's as though the tremors are starting to kick in, but don't get going. And the network is picking up on that. Most importantly, if we look at about the 30-second mark, again, there's another spike. The network again is saying something's going to happen here. Tremors are about to occur. And this is what we're looking at to provide, which is what we're about now, a feedback loop in order to just apply the tremors at that time. It doesn't matter if we apply the signal too often to counteract the tremors. That's not a problem, but it must reliably provide it before tremors occur. So that's where we're about now, applying the feedback loop and starting to test it out so that we've got an intelligent feedback stimulating mechanism rather than just this open loop stimulating mechanism. But of course it has all sorts of other potential uses. This is for Parkinson's disease therapy, all very nice. In the future, of course, it doesn't have to be. I mean, for, let's say, a flippant use of it, maybe you could put it into the brain of your husband and wife, and when you're going away for a few days, it's a sort of an anti-fancier person of the opposite sex device, so that if they look at somebody else, it can predict they're going to look at somebody else, and stop them. No, there we go. It's just to point out that when we're looking at devices like this, there is perhaps an immediate potential therapeutic use, but the same technology can also be used for other purposes. So if we're looking, making some ethical decision, therapy is okay, enhancement not so sure about, it's a very, very naive point of view. I don't, what's therapy for one is enhancement for another, and a device that could be developed for one thing can clearly be used for another. And that's shown even more with this. This is Campbell Aird. Campbell lost his original arm due to cancer, and he's been given this articulated arm. But you'll see him controlling the robot arm with his left hand, with his good hand, if you like. He's flicking a switch in order to control the robot hand, which seems very silly. It would be much better if he could control the robot hand directly from his brain, so that his brain signals, his neural signals, move the hand, move the arm, and when the hand touches an object, signals go back from the hand up to his brain. And that's really what my research has been about and is about mainly at the present time. But here we have a quandary, because while we can provide an interface to link the human brain and the wires of this robot arm together in a bidirectional way, okay, if this person's hand is perhaps not as powerful as our hands, yeah, that's all right and it will help him, but what if the hand is much more powerful than we have? What if it can crush a car? Is that appropriate? And more importantly, as we've been hearing about the internet, we're talking here about brain signals not just staying within the human body on the nervous system, but appearing on wires on this arm. And anybody into technology, if you've got signals appearing there, we can send them where we like. We can send those brain signals across the internet to another continent, wherever we wanted, maybe by satellite to another. No. So we're talking here about having the technology, if we can have a reliable interface, to have this technology so that your body does not have to be physically where it is now, but by linking your nervous system to the internet, your brain signals can control not just your fingers, but they can control pieces of technology on a different continent. Your body can go where the internet takes it. Think about what that might mean. And not only that, when maybe an infrared sense picks up some signals on a distant continent, those signals can be passed back down onto the wires up to your brain. So your senses don't have to be on your body. Your senses can be wherever the network is connected to. You can have senses on a distant planet, if you like. So, my own research. This is the last implant so far that I've had. There's me lying on the operating table, 2 hours of neurosurgery, and working with a team of 4 consultant neurosurgeons, 2 of them there, the one on the left, Amjad Shad. We're working very much with, at the present time, Peter Teddy too, but Amjad very much in the next development stage. And this is what I had implanted, 100 electrodes. Each electrode is 1.5 millimeters long. And this was fired into the median nerve fibers of my left arm. Now the median nerves are the main bunch of nerves that run from your brain down to your thumb and on your main fingers to take motor neural signals in that direction. And then if you touch your fingers, sensory information goes back up to your brain in that way. And there's also temperature and all sorts of other signals that we don't fully understand. But this was fired into my neural system. Just to be clear, I wasn't wearing this in my top pocket or anything like that. This was fired in pneumatically into my nervous system to make a direct electrical contact. The nerve fibers, there are about 10,000 of them, and altogether they are about 3.5 to 4 millimeters in diameter. This total number of, I like to think mine are 4 millimeters in diameter. It's a guy thing, I guess. But these 1.5 millimeters fired into about 4, so it's not quite halfway, to make direct electrical contact bidirectionally. So if I move my hand, my neural signals, my brain signals, could be picked up via the implant, transmitted off wherever we wanted them to, via the internet, and also back the other way. We could pick up signals, play them down onto the array, onto my nervous system to stimulate my brain. Now I've got a little clip here from Discovery TV. It's got some nice music on it, give you some idea what we got up to.
One man in human technology is the world's first cyborg. Part man, part machine. Kevin Warwick, cybernetics professor at Reading University, England, took a peek into the future as long ago as 2002. For 3 months, a silicon chip was implanted into the nerves in his arm.
At that time, no human had had an implant of this type before.
It was a procedure that until then had only been tested on chickens.
Would the body reject it? Would it affect the way I moved or my sensory capabilities? I could have lost the use of my hand. Could it affect my brain? Ultimately, could it send me crazy?
Kevin was plugged into a computer which monitored the nerve signals from his brain to his arm, receiving and transmitting them as radio waves. With the signals from his brain, Kevin could not only turn on lights, he could control a wheelchair. And from 5,000 kilometers away via the internet, he succeeded in getting a robot hand to mimic his own hand movements. His most impressive experiment involved his wife, Irena, also having a chip implanted in her arm.
The communication experiment between myself and Irena was vitally important. This was the highlight of the whole experiment.
Kevin wanted to discover if it was possible for his brain to receive and feel signals from Irena's brain.
When Irena first moved her hand, it actually felt like a chime running up my index finger. It was a phenomenal feeling. Literally, every time she moved, my brain received a signal. There we were communicating for the first time in the world, nervous system to nervous system.
It was the first time two people had electronically communicated by thought alone.
In the short term, we're going to see implants used to help people who are paralyzed switch on lights, operate the TV, just by thinking about it.
In 30 years, he believes we'll all have chips in our brains.
But ultimately, having extra memory, having downloads from the computer, uploaded from the brain. Earth is going to be controlled by cyborgs. Humans are going to be something of a subspecies.
We'll be half man, half machine, with super memory, super senses and superpowers.
I think quite clearly that's where we're going. Superhuman.
I'd be warned with that. Just to say, if you want to find any more, there's coincidentally today on MSNBC.com, if any of you have MSNBC.com, there is, if you go down to the video section, there's an interview on. I'm not sure how long it'll stay on there, but there's an interview on there today. I think it's on NBC today as well, a brief bit. But what we were doing was working with the National Spinal Injuries Centre in the UK and looking at could this technology be useful for people with spinal injuries. And hopefully you can see with all of the things we're looking at there, there are two aspects to all of them. The robot arm potentially for people who've had their hand amputated, as we saw with Campbell Aird, but also looking at the enhancement of controlling things like that over the technology of the internet or whatever it happens to be, the therapy enhancement aspects for both times. Now, one or two holiday snaps just to finish with, if that's all right, Renata. Renata has a little daughter called Irena, and I have a little wife called Irena. I shouldn't say little wife. She's smaller than me anyway. And Irena was fantastic. She helped with the project in many ways. And here she's wearing some jewellery that a student at the Royal College of Art put together. And the jewellery changes colour from red to blue. So it's I think you were looking earlier at wearable computing, and in a way this is one aspect of that. But potentially for health purposes, so she's wearing jewellery, but it's linked to my nervous system via the implant. And there are two ways that we could potentially operate it. One, just with my hand closed, the jewellery was red, and hand open, jewellery turned blue. But on the nervous system, of course, like Ros Picard earlier talking about looking at anger and stress and getting indications of those sort of physical emotions, you could describe them. And clearly by monitoring the nervous system, you can get other signals of that type. For example, if I was to go, shock, this is audience participation, you have to put a little box there. Sorry if I woke anybody up, Or if any of you just peed yourself, I'm even sorry, but if you do, please leave now. The point is, I'm trying to say that if I had been monitoring your nervous system then, clearly, when you, like that, we would have got distinct signals that, yes, this person is shocked. That's what I was trying to point out. Excitement is another thing. If you're nice and calm, you get one set of signals, you get excited, the signals look completely different. So if you can imagine now, put yourself in the picture, my wife Irena is wearing the jewellery, it's connected to my nervous system. When I'm nice and calm and relaxed, the jewellery is blue, and when I get excited, it starts flashing red. So she is in her office, walking around, the jewellery is blue, no problem, he's not doing anything he shouldn't. The jewellery starts flashing red, what is he doing? And more importantly, who is he doing it with? Possibilities. This is taken at Columbia University, New York, and the guys there helped put my nervous system live onto the internet, and we did the experiment with the robot hand. So I was in New York and the robot hand was in Reading in the UK. I moved my hand in New York, my neural signals were sent across the internet to move the robot hand, pretty accurate servo following of the robot for the robot hand of my hand. But when the robot hand gripped an object, signals were sent back from fingertip sensors on the robot hand across the internet to stimulate my nervous system. So what we were doing was, as the hand gripped more and more, my brain received an increased frequency of current pulse. So the force in the fingertips was translated into an increased frequency of stimulating current for my brain. And I was able, with the blindfold on, I was able to get pretty fine control of the robot hand on another continent, getting feedback from the fingertips of the robot hand. This is one of the five things I mentioned at the start. I've got a baseball cap, a Computer Associates, who was one of our sponsors on the baseball cap, but also ultrasonic sensors. And the output from the sonar sensors, the output from the ultrasonic sensors was fed down via the implant to stimulate my nervous system. Again, if an object came close by, my brain received an increased frequency of current pulse, and if object further away, the current pulses died away. And so with a blindfold on, what I was doing was moving around, and I could detect objects. I didn't know what they were, but I could detect them and hence avoid them. So clearly it has a potential role for somebody who's blind, not to repair the blindness in any way, but to give that person a different sense. So it has a therapeutic purpose, but also for anybody, it's an extra sense, an ultrasonic sense, directly. So we were avoiding the normal sensory route. So we weren't converting ultrasonic signals into vision or tactile or the normal five senses. We had commandeered nerve fibers and were opening up a new sensory input in that sense. All questions as to how the brain adapts for that. But certainly ultrasonics work. Ian, the assistant, would move the board towards me, and what I was trying to do was to stay the distance away, the same distance away from the board, using the ultrasonic signals. And if he moved the board away, I was trying to follow it purely on the ultrasonic signals. But the final bit of the experiment with Irena again, and what she had were electrodes pushed into her nervous system from the outside. This is something you can try tonight if you like, on yourselves, or if you have a friend. Whether they'll still be a friend afterwards is another question. But now, if you push thin electrodes into your nervous system, you will find it is extremely painful. And we thought she was going to get some anaesthetic, but the doctor said, no, I need to make sure I've made good contact here. So he pushed the electrode in, and she screamed, and the doctor said, I think we've made a good contact there. And we went back to the lab and linked our nervous systems together. And essentially, when she moved her hand, her neural signal that did that was sent across a network within the lab, and stimulated my nervous system. So every time she moved her hand, my brain received a pulse. So literally when she tick, 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 my brain got tick, 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 three pulses, and so on. So we communicated telegraphically directly from nervous system to nervous system. And quite clearly, I can see the next step on that research is to do it brain to brain, telegraphic communication. Still a few questions, it's coming clearer now, but a few questions as to exact positioning and the nature of bidirectional signaling, but brain to brain communication, I would put as within the next 6 to 7 years, in a telegraphic sense, will be brought about. The basis of thought communication. As for how far we can go in terms of parallel signaling and ideas and colours, well, that's research. We've got to head there. But it's a tremendously exciting opportunity. It clearly opens up possibilities for people with locked-in syndrome and patients that have difficulty communicating, allowing them to communicate in a new way. But for all of us, it opens up the possibility of communicating by thought alone, ultimately, from brain to brain. Just to conclude, though, and there is a note of caution in this, that clearly if we look at upgrading and having extra memory, if that's possible, and extra mathematical abilities, certainly ultrasonic, extra sensory input, communicating in new ways, maybe thinking in new dimensions, all of these are intellectually important aspects that would put cyborgs as being far superior to regular humans. So if there are those of you that feel, no, you don't want to have anything to do with these implants, fine, it's your choice. So, you know, no one's going to, if you want to be part of some subspecies in the future, that's up to you. But as far as I'm concerned, just to conclude, I did mention that very eminent politician, Arnold Schwarzenegger, earlier, and I'd like to conclude with some very profound words from him. And that is that I have been a cyborg in the past, and as far as being a cyborg is concerned in the future, I'll be back. Thank you.
To access the most accurate and relevant health information that affects you, your family, and your community, please visit www.cdc.gov.